CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to our Business Masterclass. I'm Richard Angus, CEO of the finance team, your part-time financial executive solution. Joining me in studio as part of our panel is Safia Boulay of New Habits, Making Shift Happen.
How's it, Richard?
Thanks for being with us, Safia, as always. Last week, we spoke to Mason Mahiri, the Solutions Director at Law Trust, on the sticky subject of cyber attacks and what every business should know.
Safia, and it was scary.
It was very scary, and we, in fact, will be doing some follow-up shows on that. We just realized how little we do know about what goes on out there and what we need to be focusing on. So today, we're going to be talking about that whole question of entrepreneurial failure, how to handle this within the legal and governance environment, because we all know that that's a little bit of a challenging space. Joining us on the line from Cape Town is our guest, Belinda Dovestone of the Sadar Group. And in studio.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Belinda. And in studio, we have Manisha Prem, a commercial law attorney. Welcome, Manisha.
Thank you.
So, Manisha and Belinda, I'll put it to you that we have these lovely statistics that tell us that 7 out of 10 businesses fail in the first 2 years. That's not a great statistic to have. You know, 30% pass rate doesn't blow anybody away. And we hear things like we should support entrepreneurship because that's the future of our country. So this sounds great. We've got a, you know, low success rate of successful businesses after 2 years, yet we recognize that entrepreneurship is a critical part of how we take our country forward. So we've kind of got those two contrasts on either side of the balancing beam. And then we have the governance and legal framework where we have things like you've started up your company, you have signed various documents, you are now a director, we have this new thing called the Companies Act of 2008, and suddenly you've got things like director's liability, you have to worry about what you've signed for at the bank and other financial institutions potentially, and there's huge liability questions lurking in this, and I'm going, well, guys, if we want to create a safe space to enhance entrepreneurship as a country, we've also got to now contrast that with the, let's call it the liability and let's call it the commercial elements of, well, other people also get involved in your business, your lenders, your funders, etc. They're taking risks, or maybe they are, maybe they're not. What level of, you know, and I kind of looked at all of this and I went, wow, it's not a great space to be as an entrepreneur if it fails from a, let's call it a liability and legal perspective and a responsibility perspective. And then you look at the stats and you say, and 70% of entrepreneurs are going to end up in this situation. Belinda, give us some sense of, I mean, I've used a mouthful now, but when I say, though, give you that kind of context, what immediately springs to mind for you as a director and governance expert? I mean, what's your thinking in that space? How do we deal with this little challenge?
Well, it certainly is. It is a scary place, very much so. And I think that, you know, as much as we think that entrepreneurs are battling with the Companies Act and their director's duties, you know, large private companies are often completely unaware of the how challenging their actions are and what the liability they face. So, you know, it's a broad spectrum of problems, right from the startup right to, you know, really large private companies. I think that the real nitty-gritty, and remember we spoke about this analogy of a child, a company being a child, and how you as a parent have to look after the child. And so one of the things to think about is that it takes a tribe to raise a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very strong on this view that in order to develop entrepreneurs, in the midst of the complexity, we have to create structures around which growing companies, startups, entrepreneurs can get the support and the knowledge to do what they're doing in, you know, in terms of the law, but also to focus on growing businesses that contribute to the economy. So, you know, particularly the whole incubator world, the role of private and public money to support and develop competency is a really nitty-gritty part of what we need to think about when we think about the governance and growth part of organizations.
Now, I mean, I guess for me, the question is one of going, well, governance is and controls are all extremely necessary. And I mean, as a chartered accountant, I'm the control person. I not like to know that things are properly managed and there's an, let's call it an order of how things happen. Unfortunately, entrepreneurs are less than orderly in their thinking and often in their approach to business. And we all know this. I mean, you talk to any entrepreneur and, you know, you kind of got to keep all your hands, you know, closely together, because if you start moving your hands around, you unfocus the conversation. They want to, you know, it's really difficult to focus and make sure you're on point. And I think entrepreneurship by its very nature, we've had previous shows where we've talked about originality and creativity. How do you align, let's call it the original creative and the world of, let's call it, and I'm not so much concerned about governance per se. I think governance has a slightly different space here. More the question of things like legal liability. I mean, at the end of the day, somebody's going to have to try and help fund this great idea that's going to change the world that the entrepreneur is busy working on. And, you know, 7 out of 10 ideas are not going to fly. How does one manage that crossover between creativity and originality and liability and, let's call it, accountability to the dotted line that has been signed on in the business?
It is a great challenge, Richard, and I think that it's about, you know, recognizing that sometimes there's two dimensions for me. One is very often transition businesses that are founded by people who are leaving, you know, corporate employment to start their own business. Usually, all their own money is what is at risk, because you know, mm-hmm. you're putting your bond in and your or your family money, so it's normally contained. And the startups are obviously looking for funding from government projects and other types of sources mm-hmm. that won't easily get, you know, bank money, you know, traditional money that easily. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of those two processes of where does the risk lie of what you lose and what you're up against. And then part of it's also recognizing that a lot of companies that are started up based on a product mm-hmm. or an innovation or a concept or an idea. And very often we make the assumption because you came up with the idea, you have to be the head of the company. So I think there's work for us to do of realizing that, you know, being the genius that comes up with the great innovation or the idea should actually get support to make sure the idea is great and go through a proven concept phase, but may not necessarily be or the right person to run the company. And if we help people to rethink that transition point and say maybe you can be the innovator and stay there and get a team around you to help take great companies to the next level, assuming your business model has legs to go the distance. And the education and the support of a type of incubation type space where you've got best practice thinking to support, I think is absolutely critical.
Okay. Belinda, maybe this is Belinda for you, Belinda, or maybe it's for Manisha. But so what I've learned recently is that many, very often entrepreneurs are only succeeding in their business the third time around. So twice before they might have put everything in and lost everything. And sometimes they go completely bankrupt and then they can't be directors again. I might be wrong in that. What strategy can an entrepreneur or business owner put in place so that they can actually be participate in running their company at an executive level when they are now recovering from a bankruptcy? Is that a tough question?
It is. Shall I go for it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, from a legal point of view, Manisha, maybe you can give us some insight around the insolvency part of it and the delinquency director stuff. But I think that it is about recognizing, I think, that when you use someone else's money to fund your business, you do have a responsibility. And the law is trying to protect the greater community from a breach in that responsibility. So it's not necessarily that, you know, something has failed, but learning that actually it is somebody else's money. Mm-hmm. And we have a responsibility to that, you know, to that process. So that's the one part. But there are lots of ways that people can be rehabilitated if they've been gone bankrupt and insolvent, that there's always an opportunity to get back in. But it's just, how do we create the structures to prevent someone from going down that path in the first place? I think is prevention is better than the cure. I think.
Yeah.
Nisha, your views?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that prevention, I mean, that's a big message for entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. is that we need to think about, there is creativity, like Richard mentioned, but we have to balance formality. We have to understand that we are operating in an organized trade environment. Mm-hmm. Our economy is not a free economy. There are rules of engagement. And even though we are creative, we have to understand the limitations mm-hmm. of how we behave as business owners. Mm. And that's when law comes in. And this is a message that I believe is, you know, I feel strongly about, because I think entrepreneurs as a last thought would consider the legal compliance, the governance, what if things went wrong, risk mitigation.
Mm.
So in terms of avoiding or future loss or even liquidation of a business, I think there are various structures that you can put into mm-hmm. place, whether it is organizing your assets at some critical point in your business or organizing your legal structure of the way you're operating
mm-hmm.
in the form of using various entities, and also being very smart about how you're accessing capital. Not all capital is free and easy to use. There are consequences to it. And if things start looking like it's heading south, you need to be very proactive quite quickly. And there are mechanisms that our legislation has provided in terms of business rescue, in terms of reaching out, in terms of mentorship, in terms of consolidating debt, before that debt actually impacts you from a personal perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're talking about sequestration in a personal capacity versus liquidation or winding up or deregistration of a company.
Okay.
And those things can be managed at various levels if you have the right structures in place.
I was going to say, I think, you know, the question that Safia's asked is very relevant in terms of, it is the extreme of the scenarios where somebody actually has allowed themselves to end up as a sequestrated individual because they've just lost everything. They've maxed everything out and gone full ball. The one thing that I'm always interested in, and Belinda and Renisha, you can possibly give me some insights here, is I think there's this continuum of how people choose to do business. You get people that start up with the intention of, let me call it, shielding their personal assets and almost running a business where they're using other people's money to try out their great idea.
Yeah.
And if it goes south, well, don't worry, the funders will lose their money, but my house is locked up behind a family trust and I'm okay. And I think, you know, if I think to my days in banking, my question was always, you know, what's this person got to lose if this transaction doesn't work? And you want to make sure as a banker and as somebody who's lending depositors' funds that you're not taking more risk than the person whose idea or business it is. I mean, that just stands to reason. And I think there's almost this continuum of, and I certainly have the sense of saying, you know, you have to be fair, and it's about, and I guess, you know, and then you get to the legal world and people say, well, what's fairness? It's what's in the contract that's important. But there is a fairness element of saying, you know, it's not appropriate to try and shield and hide your assets if you're putting somebody else on the line if they don't know they're on the line. So you need to, you know, there's always the, excuse me, the legal contract and the concept. I mean, often, you know, people almost go, you know, it's only the big banks that throw this massive legal contract at you and you don't know what you're getting into. But I often think, you know, that happens because everybody's trying to protect themselves, because not everybody's being absolutely transparent and honest about what they're doing and what the risk elements are. And, you know, I'm taking money from the bank with the full knowledge that I'm trying to avoid ever having to repay it if it goes wrong, versus saying, listen, you know, I'm going to make sure that this money is repaid regardless of the situation. I need time, I need, you know, capability, etc., but I will see to my obligations. So, yeah, I mean, how if somebody is aggressively structuring their world, I mean, Manisha, you're in the commercial law space, so maybe the question to you. I mean, do you advise people to get, let me call it, overly aggressive around how they structure? How do you deal with that fine line between, let's call it, the moral suasion of saying, I'm taking money from somebody else to help me run my business, and the line of, I have a moral obligation to repay versus, you know, I'm protecting myself? Because the other side of this is, when people are lenders, they also sometimes, or funders, they sometimes do want to take more than their fair share as well. So let's not pretend that it doesn't work in the opposite direction. So yeah, the entrepreneur, I've seen many entrepreneurs, when you see these agreements that they've been taken to and told sign this, you kind of look at this and you go, my goodness, somebody really took advantage of the entrepreneur. So there are two sides. And I'm not saying that this is a one-sided conversation where the entrepreneur wants to take from the funders. It does work the other way as well. What are your views? What have you seen out there?
So firstly, as entrepreneurs, it becomes more and more difficult to avoid disclosing your assets or your structures or your personal wealth because of the legislations around our financial institutions, mm-hmm. from whether it is the FICA legislation or the National Credit Act or the way we are lending. But there needs to be complete transparency, and you'll find that most commercial or all commercial banks are going to need full disclosure as to where your assets lie. And it becomes more difficult to try and conceal that if you bring in an application to a commercial institution.
And in fact, there's a fine line between structuring your life and concealing assets, because the moment you start concealing assets, you're into very murky water in terms of fraud and the likes.
Yeah, so certainly. But where structuring and creating an organizational, developing an organizational structure, it works when you have established critical wealth and cash flow, where you have proven concepts and you've gone to market, and now you have, firstly, sufficient income in order to be able to set up these sophisticated structures. Mm-hmm. To do it anytime sooner, at startup phase, pre-startup, to set up multiple multiple entities and trusts. First of all, it's very expensive. Mm-hmm. It's administratively, it's a burden. And thirdly, it may not work for you because you don't have enough assets and income in order to have the benefit of that structure. I would only advise to do this if in the event of having proven success in your products and services. And in that way, you're able to protect your margins, so there's no cannibalization. You're creating different teams. You have a more focused approach. You have a strategy of growth. And it could work in slightly more in higher growth or mature entities, or at a different, as I say, when you have a critical mass in terms of activity, cash flow, turnover, growth, etc.
Now, just a question. I mean, from the perspective of the world that we've got out there, where the entrepreneurs trying to make it happen, and it's not always as obvious, you know, where's the line between liability, let's call it rational liability, and a case of somebody saying, listen, I'm really taking a risk, you know, an extended risk, so to speak. How does one know where to go as an entrepreneur? I mean, how far down the line does one push structuring? I mean, you're saying there's a cost element, obviously, that features, which I can understand. I guess there's also a concern around things like I've got a family, a house, you know, all of these kind of, let's call it, personal assets. I need to decide how much of that I'm prepared to potentially risk in any environment. And often I think, you know, this is where the spouse comes in, because often it's a case of, well, I'm happy to help you in your business, darling, and I'm happy to support you, but I'm not prepared to put my house on the line. You know, and then you kind of go, well, actually, you're by implication putting the house on the line if your husband or wife is involved in a business and you're married in with an ANC with accrual or something like this. You by implication become involved. I guess we've always on the show advised people to make sure that they take professional advice in these sort of things. So, Manisha, I mean, in your experience as a commercial lawyer, when should entrepreneurs be engaging and saying, Mr. or Mrs. Lawyer, where are the lines? What should I be doing? What should I be doing? Do they do that up front? Do they spend the money up front and engage with somebody like yourself, somebody out there? What should they be doing?
So, with engaging an attorney, firstly, I understand that there are budgetary and cost limitations at a startup phase or at the beginning of a business. There's a lot of information available online. There's a lot of access to information at the CIPC. So if you're looking to read and get knowledge, there's information available. And like Belinda mentioned, through the development of SMEs through private-public cooperation, there's a lot of programs where there's legal advice and there are attorneys that are doing pro bono work or at a reduced rate to help SMEs. There are some attorneys that focus on SMEs only, and so they have structured fees and packages in order to assist companies that are unable to afford expensive legal assistance. So there's definitely information and advice available, and I think the sooner you consult a lawyer or the sooner you are aware of what your rights, duties, and limitations are as a business owner, the more prepared you are for potential future loss and liability. And in terms of liability, I think that if you don't have income in your business or cash flow, you should not be accessing capital at all, because then you are putting your personal assets and your personal life at risk, because you are unable to raise the capital on its own on the back of your business exclusively, which means that you have to rethink your strategy and think at the beginning, I need incremental organic growth, where I'm growing by one unit at a time versus at a mature or a later stage where I'm growing inorganically and looking to raise large capital to acquire opportunities, entering new territories, etc.
Now, Belinda, I mean, you're very silent on the other side. Have we still got you with us?
I'm here.
Okay, good. Belinda, I mean, you sit on boards. You've experienced boards within the SADR governance space. What is the view of, let's call them external parties? I mean, you know, as a company grows and scales, one of the key parts of governance is to bring in other parties to contribute to the growth of the entity through thinking, etc., and risk help with the risk management process, etc. And that's where governance obviously kicks to the next level of having an independent non-executive on your board, for example. You know, when you guys step into the environment, I guess the entities are a little bigger, but the reality is those entities still are subject to the risks of failure and the likes. What do you experience as directors on boards when you've got that, let's call it that next stage scale up that's kind of kicked into play and the risks amount, and suddenly, you know, you're faced with the challenges of things are potentially going south. And now you've got to deal with this as a director and as a member of that board. What are you guys going to be doing in that sort of space? What is your response to these sort of challenges?
Well, I think that the most important thing is that, you know, you have exactly the same risks in a small environment to a large private company. The fallout is just greater the bigger the company gets. So, you know, we've seen some pretty scary things in what directors are doing at, you know, large private companies. Actually, literally this week have done some coaching with a director around this exact process where the director in the founding days of the company, in the startup days, was successful due to his maverick nature, his ability yeah. to drive change and get things done. And when you're a large private company, not all that maverick nature is useful. In fact, yeah. it can be quite counterproductive. Yeah. You can't make decisions in the corridor with your fellow directors. There's a way of working that is different. And so what we experienced in this particular case was decisions being made where, you know, unbeknownst to the director, even though, you know, he's a director of a very large private company, was putting his entire personal state at jeopardy by his behavior as a director. And the specific case is being a shareholder in the holding company and being a director of a subsidiary company, and as the shareholder demanding that the subsidiary repay the loan that was made to it by the holding company.
Okay.
Following the story. Yeah. And as a director of a subsidiary, you demanding that that loan gets repaid even though it breaches solvency and liquidity requirements means firstly that should it all hit the fan, you might be held personally liable and you might lose your nice big house. And then the second part of it is that the directors in the subsidiary might go to court and ask the court, do you, have you declared as a delinquent director, and say, you actually cannot perform as a director because of your behavior, and therefore you can't be a director on any company. So you know, those are the processes and remedies that are there, and the bigger the company, the more the fallout. And we are still to this day surprised how little directors understand about both the one hand, the glove, the fist glove, which says there's penalties, and on the other hand, there's remedies. And you have to know what you're doing so that you know how to use both at the right time.
Well, I must say, Belinda, it sounds like we've, and Manisha, we've got a real tough environment with lots of issues to consider. As we always say on shows of this nature, this show carries a health warning. Please consult the professionals before you make a decision about this, because this is definitely an area where as they always say, the advice that you pay for is the advice that you can count on.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to know the exact circumstances and the intricate natures of your individual circumstances before you make a call. So, Belinda, thank you very much for joining us on the show. We really do appreciate your insights. Manisha, thank you very much. We really do appreciate your insights. It's been great to talk about this. I think we definitely have to think a little more about how we handle this going forward. It's definitely, you know, as entrepreneurship grows in stature in the South African economy, these challenges are going to grow with that, and it's going to be something that we're going to have to deal with on a more regular basis as South Africans. So, yeah, an interesting space to be in. So thanks very much for joining us. Thanks to our guests. Up next is our business conversation. Stay with us. CliffCentral.com.